Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Freedom of Species is a radio program dedicated to raising awareness about issues concerning animals. The program is broadcast from the 3CR studios in Melbourne, Australia, and streamed live via the 3CR website. Recent podcasts are available from both the 3CR and Freedom of Species websites. I'm Kate Gracie, and welcome to the show. I've got Dennis Black with me in the studio today. Dennis is a zoologist with a doctorate from the University of California, Davis, but with most of his career spent here in Australia. He's also a lover of frogs, and he's going to share that love of frogs with us, as well as share some really bad news. And here's a clue, biodiversity crisis. So welcome to the 3CR studio, Dennis. First time at 3CR?
Yes, it is, Kate. Thank you.
Now, is there a term for people who love to look at frogs like yourself? Like bird people are called twitchers. Is there a term for frog people?
Probably included in the term herpo. So reptiles and amphibians.
Okay, so like when you're talking with other frog people, are you kind of herpos? Is that kind of a term?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. We'll go with that. So, and tell me, does everyone love frogs? Because they seem to elicit some level of affection in just about everybody I've met. I'm not sure if that's just the circles I move in, or is it just everybody likes frogs? A little bit?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say everybody. I've met a few people who do have a bit of a phobia.
Oh, really?
They consider them to be slimy little things and cold, and they just would prefer not to have to touch them.
Oh, okay. I've never met a person yet, any of those people yet, thankfully. Mm. But everyone I've met thinks frogs are great, and everyone sort of goes out of their way to help a frog who's just caught in a sticky situation, which sort of restores my faith in humanity a little bit, I suppose. Now, you've met a lot of frogs in your work as a zoologist. Can you tell me about a few of your favourite ones?
Yes, I've mainly been Australian frogs. Probably my favourite one, it was on an expedition to the Northern Simpson Desert with the Queensland Geographical Society, where we were there for 2 weeks after a fairly good rainfall. And we had gone with the intention on this expedition, a couple of us from La Trobe Uni had gone, to do specific projects. But when we got to the site where we were supposed to work, there were little spadefoot toads everywhere. They had responded to that that recent rain event, and had emerged and were still around and active. It doesn't happen very often. We just happened to be there at the right time, so we changed our plans for the some of the projects we had planned, and ended up looking in detail at the frogs that were around. Incredible little things that spend most of their lives in the sand and soil and only emerge after a decent rain to feed and to breed.
So when they're submerged in soil, are they asleep? Are they in some kind of stupor while they're underground?
Well, I think they're capable of dropping their metabolism to fairly low levels so that they don't do very much. Frogs have pretty small brains, so I don't imagine there's a lot going on in the head during that quiescent phase.
Right. And when you talk about it's a spadefoot frog, what does the spadefoot frog mean?
Well, it's actually a term borrowed from a North American species that they're called spadefoot toads. And They used their hind legs for burrowing into the soil or sand, and the feet and legs are roughly shaped like a spade that they use for digging. So that's where the name comes from.
Wow. And how often would they come up?
Well, again, it depends on rain events. So if it's been a good year and you have regular rain events in these very dry areas, they'll emerge after each one. But they could go, some of the frogs that are in the arid zone in Australia can go up for years before a decent rain event comes along, and they'll remain quiescent until that occurs.
And survive. Wow, that's incredible. Mm. That's amazing. Any other frogs that have got a special place in your heart?
Well, I recently had to give up a fantastic lowland rainforest property in Queensland to move back to Melbourne. And
that must have hurt.
There was a whole range of beautiful frogs. We had a little creek running through the property. And after a decent rain, the cacophony of sound from that creek was amazing. I literally had to cover my ears when I went down to the creek. So we're talking about a dozen different species of frogs calling at the same time.
You must have been in heaven.
It was pretty amazing. There was other amazing wildlife as well, but I think the frogs were probably the best aspect of that property.
Yeah, right. Have you got to know frogs personally? Have you spent time with individual frogs?
Oh, I've had frogs as housemates.
Really?
I worked in New Guinea for 3 years and was based in Port Moresby and worked at UPNG. But we had a white-lipped tree frog that lived in the house. That's actually also in Australia. It's the largest Australian frog species. And they're widely sold as pets in the U.S. now, unfortunately. But I did have an individual in the house, living in the house in Port Moresby most of the time we were there, until one unfortunate encounter with my wife one night when she stepped on the thing.
Oh, no.
Didn't injure the frog, but the deal was, if it ever happened, the frog had to go outside. So.
Oh, bad luck, frog.
Yes.
He had to live outside from there on. Hmm. That's unfortunate. Now, do you know if frogs, because you've spent time with frogs, do you know if frogs have, individual frogs have personalities? Because, I know for a fact that chickens are vastly underestimated in the personality stakes. So are pigs. So are lots of animals. I'm just wondering if the same might apply to frogs and they have a range of personalities that we're just not aware of.
Well, I haven't been able to compare individuals within a species, but there, on our property south of Cairns, there was one little green tree frog that had taken up residence in, it was a metal panel that covered some wiring going into our shed. And it was also associated with a faucet. And every time we went to use the faucet to water the garden or do whatever, it immediately responded by coming right up to the top of this little metal box and poking its head up so that we would give it a shower.
Oh, right.
And it worked without fail. It would disappear during dry periods, but really dry periods, but then it would reappear again and it would be there every time we were using the tap.
Right.
So that, to me, at least suggests that frogs can learn. And I think that individual had a personality, but I don't know if another green tree frog would be capable of doing the same thing.
Yeah. I suspect frogs are, I don't know, I suspect if we get to know individual animals from all different kinds of species, we'd be amazed about the diversity of personality. That's what I hope, anyway. I'm also aware that there's some pretty fascinating frogs out there, like there's glass frogs and there's hip pocket frogs and there's gastric brooding frogs, even though I think they're extinct now. And my little boy has told me about poison dart frogs, and they're all amazing. Are there any standout amazing frogs for you?
Well, you've mentioned two of them from Australia there that I find incredible. The hip pocket frog, I used to think way back when, was the most amazing because of its reproductive habits of the male carrying the tadpoles around in little pockets on its legs, until I heard about gastric brooding frogs. Now these, from a reproductive point of view, they were probably the most amazing vertebrates on the planet, not just frogs, but where the female swallowed the eggs, tadpoles developed in her stomach. She had to turn off her gastric juices to prevent them from being digested. And after 6 or 7 weeks, little metamorphlings, baby frogs, emerged from the mouth of the female. Now, I'm not aware of any other vertebrates that do that. It really was amazing. And unfortunately, the two species we had in Australia disappeared in the early 80s, and there's been no sign of them since.
Ah, hopefully one day one of those frogs might reappear. So is there a chance that we might find one of those remarkable gastric brooding frogs?
Oh, well, there are a lot of areas in Australia that haven't been properly explored yet. Most of the new frogs that have been described in the last decade or two have been frogs from the arid zone, because, of course, it takes us longer to actually do detailed research in areas like that. But I suspect up in the far north, in some of those remote rainforest areas, there are certainly frogs we haven't discovered yet.
Is that where the gastric brooding frogs came from? Rainforest frogs?
They were sort of wet forests, but more south-central Queensland, southern Queensland, and in somewhat drier forests. And it's suspected that, it's not certain what led to their demise. Possibly climate change issues, the drying of those forests. But I think this chytrid fungus has also been implicated in their loss.
Right. I live in hope that we might yet see a gastric brooding frog. Is there any frogs on your bucket list that you'd really like to meet?
Well, you mentioned one of the other ones, the whole group of species, the poison arrow frogs in South America. It's one of the few things I'd really like to see if I ever make it to South America, because there's such elegant little animals, but potentially deadly.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so you sort of observe them from a safe distance.
Yes.
Be advisable. Now, I want to talk to you about this, about the frog crisis that's going on and the chytrid fungus issue. But we're just going to have a break for a song, and I want you, it's the song that you brought in, Dennis. Could you just introduce your song, and we'll play that, and we'll come back and talk about the serious frog issue.
Okay, this song is from Ted Egan, who's a person I really admire for all of his work with Indigenous people in the Northern Territory. And he has this beautiful children's album, and Yurupunga Frog is one of the songs from that album.
Let's give it a go.
Here's a song about a very cheeky frog.
You're listening to Freedom of Species on 3CR Community Radio, and that was a song called The Yurupunga Frog by Ted Egan. We're talking to Dennis Black, who is a zoologist with a special interest in frogs. Dennis, now in Sydney I hear that there's been an alarming decline in numbers of the once ubiquitous tree frog. Can you tell us what's happening there with the Sydney tree frog?
To be honest, I don't know the specifics of what's happening with that species, but it's not at all surprising because we have many similar declines occurring in Melbourne. It's a phenomenon that is common in urban areas. Frog populations generally don't do well in suburbia. So the probable causes are usually air pollution, water pollution, or simple loss of habitat, suitable habitat. Those are the most likely causes of decline, and certainly that's what happened in the Melbourne area.
Right. What are the frogs in the Melbourne area that are meeting, that are seeing the same kind of decline as the Sydney tree frog?
Well, there are quite a few. One of the ones that was really impacted years ago was the growling grass frog.
Oh, and, yeah.
It was when I was working at Monash Uni back in the 70s. It was one of the most common frogs you would come across when you went out into areas in Gippsland. But now populations have declined dramatically. And there was some concern about what was happening in the Melbourne region about them, particularly along the Mary Creek corridor. And due to that concern, there were lots of factors that were mitigated, if you like, that have led to an enormous resurgence of that frog. It's been positively impacted by revegetation and wetlands rehabilitation and that sort of thing.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
A good news story after all.
That's one of the good news stories. But we've got an amazing network of people in Melbourne, volunteers, who are monitoring local frog populations. And they report to government agencies who are collecting the data. And so that's actually another good news story about what's happening locally.
That's fantastic. Mm. That's really good. Now, I know that the same can't be said for many of the other frogs around the world. There's been reports of a much more alarming decline in frog species right across the globe, and it's a really, really serious situation. And that's the chytrid fungus disease that's decimating frog populations. Can you please expand on that?
Yes, it's a bit curious. Well, where it came from, it's probably always been in natural systems right around the world, but for some reason, since about the 1970s, it has become much more impacting on frog populations. Now, chytrid fungi are generally a very large group, and this particular fungus is probably the only one that impacts vertebrates. It's in a large group of fungi that do have impacts otherwise. But with this impact on frogs, it's global, and it's been spreading. I mean, since it was first discovered in the early 90s in Australia, it's been fairly well documented and virtually right throughout frog populations. There are a few isolated areas where it hasn't reached, but it's similar to what's happening in other parts of the world. There are lots of different strains of the fungus, so different populations are impacted differently. But it's by far not the only impact. A much more serious impact is habitat loss for frogs. I've seen estimates that habitat loss is probably four times greater in impact than the chytrid fungus is. But there is potential for the fungus to become a much greater impact.
So how does this chytrid fungus spread? Like, how's it gone around the world?
Well, we don't know how it got to Australia originally within Australia. It could be spread simply by human activities. So people active in chytrid areas actually transferring the fungus in the same way that Phytophthora, the root fungus, gets transferred around by the activities of people.
Oh, you mean like just on dirty boots?
Yeah, dirty boots.
Or tires.
Or people that have worked with frogs in an area and might pick up the fungus and knowingly transfer it to another uninfected
population. Oh, you mean like just like
population.
Handling techniques?
Yes, handling techniques. There's been a lot done to improve handling techniques because of that concern. But also introduced species could possibly be also be a source of the spread of chytrid. Cane toads come to mind.
Right.
They don't seem to have been severely impacted by chytrid, but they certainly could be capable of spreading it.
How does the chytrid fungus, how does it manifest on the frog? Like, what's the actual physiological effects of the chytrid fungus?
It grows within the keratin layer of the skin of the frog, which is in the outer sort of horny layer. And the problems it creates is that it disrupts osmotic balance, because frogs generally rely mainly on their skin for transfer of fluids. And also electrolytes get transferred through the skin, and that electrolyte transfer also gets disrupted by the chytrid fungus. So basically the physiology of the frog is adversely affected through those ways, and the frog loses condition and eventually dies if it's a virulent strain of the fungus.
Is it a sudden death? Is it sort of a...
No, it can drag on for a long time.
Right. I read recently a book, a fantastic book called The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Colbert, and she talked about the chytrid fungus in places like Panama and Costa Rica, where there used to be just masses and masses and masses of frogs, just so many, like the researchers there, heaps of researchers would go there to study frogs. And it would be like a squirming landscapes of frogs, and they've gone back, and it's just a death scene of just dead frogs everywhere, just thousands and thousands of dead frogs. Mm-hmm. And in other places where there used to be just ridiculous amounts of frogs, I just can't find any. And this has all been put down to the chytrid fungus, which is just horrific. And it's just decimating what was one of the most biodiverse places in the world for frogs. It's just now dreadful.
Well, we certainly need much more awareness about it. We need to understand how it impacts frog populations better, and we need to control its spread. There's no doubt about that. So one of the ways of doing that, of course, is making the general public much more aware of the impacts of the fungus.
Which leads me to the point about the bee crisis. There's been this massive drop in bee populations. And it's been really, really well reported. And everybody knows, I've got to do stuff for the bees. Everyone's trying to help the bees. And I just wonder if this issue can be compared, the frog issue can be compared to the bee issue. I know that the bees are obviously critical to our food supply, so there's a lot more emphasis put on the bees. But in terms of the scale, the extent of the crisis, do you think that the bee and the frog crises are comparable?
Well, when was the last time you ate a frog? No, unfortunately, I don't think they are, simply because pollination is so critical to our agricultural systems. And, of course, that's our main concern about the impact on bees, is that we rely so heavily on them for many of our pollination and many of our agricultural crops, whereas frogs really have very little economic value, generally speaking. That doesn't mean they don't have ecological value. They certainly do. But from the point of view of how we use organisms, frogs really don't come into the picture.
Which is really sad, isn't it? That we value the species that serve us, but we don't value the ones that don't. So frogs, everyone likes them. Well, as we were talking before, you know, they're cute and everybody wants to look after them, but they don't serve us particularly or directly. So they're not prioritized.
No, it's more aesthetic.
Yeah. Now, I understand that in Australia. Just even in Australia alone, let alone the rest of the world, that there's a lot of frog species that are undiscovered. That means that while all these frog populations are being decimated around the world, we're probably losing frog species that we don't even know exist.
That's true. But in our discussion earlier, I told you how I feel about the invertebrate species we're losing. And that's orders of magnitude greater than the undescribed vertebrate species. Most of the obvious vertebrates, because they're large and we encounter them, we can put scientific names on. So in terms of the numbers that haven't been described, it's a fairly low number compared to other organisms.
Yeah, indeed. Can you give some insights or ideas about why there's this invertebrate crisis going on as well? Is it the same reasons as the frog crisis, as the bee crisis, as the everything else crisis?
Well, again, the main source of loss of invertebrates is through habitat destruction.
Right.
And it's occurring mainly in areas like Southeast Asia, where they're clearing rainforests, in the Amazon basin in Central America, where they're clearing rainforests. And I mean, estimates for biodiversity based on the research that's been done in rainforest canopies are, again, an order of magnitude greater than what this recent UN report suggested. They said something like 5,000 species of animal, or sorry, 5 million species of animals. Well, estimates from people who have worked, like Terry Irwin, who have worked in the Central American rainforests, go up to 100,000. And when we're clearing thousands, hundreds of thousands of hectares of rainforest, we could be losing millions of species of invertebrates on a monthly basis. Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous to say that, oh, we're in danger of losing a million species, as they did in the United Nations report, because it doesn't take into account all of the micro species.
Mm. They never get the attention.
No.
They never get the attention. And they're so... Gosh, I mean, it's well documented that when they fail, I mean, the human species, we're in dire straits without insects in our lives.
Well, the rainforests in the Amazon basin have often been described as the lungs of the planet, and we're still clearing those at a great rate of knots.
Mm. Yeah. Now I know that zoos play a positive role in this crisis in terms of breeding captive frogs, so whole species aren't wiped out. Can you maybe talk about that role of zoos?
Well, I'm only generally aware of what happens in Melbourne. I know a few people that have been involved in breeding, not just frogs but reptiles as well, behind the scenes in Melbourne Zoo. But the other major zoos in Australia all have these breeding programs behind the scenes for species, often for species that are considered to be particularly endangered, like, for example, the alpine tree frog, one of the more notable ones at Hillsill Sanctuary, of course, is that alpine pygmy possum, which is bred there. So there is an awful lot of conservation work that goes on behind the scenes in zoos that people just generally aren't aware of.
Are those zoos going to be, are they capable of actually making, of saving a species and making a viable population? Like if they're saving a few frogs that's otherwise wiped out, other than creating a single example of an animal, or
that's basically it has to be in conjunction with restoring habitat at the same time and ensuring that the habitat is viable and can support that species again. So that ideally you'd be re-releasing that into areas where it occurred historically, but with the habitat protected.
Right. Now, obviously, there's a a big decline in frog populations is not a good thing, and extinctions are definitely not good at all. But I'm wondering, how important are frogs to a well-functioning natural ecosystem? Like, if they do go extinct, is that more than just being a shame for the frog? What's the role of the frog in a well-functioning natural ecosystem?
Well, the beauty of natural ecosystems is that they are very diverse, and that gives them flexibility. Take frogs out of a rainforest ecosystem, for example, and you've removed a terrific source of food for a lot of other organisms, and you've also taken out predators that would normally have an impact on a lot of other species within that system. So by taking the frogs out, you are decreasing the diversity and the flexibility of that system. Now, why do natural systems need flexibility? They need flexibility for the hard times. When they're going to be impacted, you can afford to lose some of those species where they overlap in their ecological roles. And that gives that ecosystem a much greater chance of recovering after the loss. So any major group of organisms that you're taking out of a system makes it that much less flexible.
Right. With that, let's just have a quick break for a song. This one, and we'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about the biodiversity crisis that's going on. But we'll just take a break, and we're going to just hear this song by Neko Case, and it's called Last Line of Albion. You're listening to Freedom of Species on 3CR Community Radio, and that last track was Neko Case with Last Line of Albion. Now, we've got Dr. Dennis Black in the studio. He's a zoologist, and we're talking about the frog crisis that's occurring around the world with massive declines in frog populations, largely due to habitat destruction and due to the chytrid fungus that's spreading around the world. Now, Dennis, I know that when we talk about the parallel bee crisis, there's been some changes in various parts of the world to chemical use and to other human behaviours, and that's been done to help the bees. What can we do to help frogs, because that's caused by a fungus that we really have little control over, and it seems pretty much to be everywhere. So what can we do to help our frogs?
It's a big question.
It is.
I might start small.
Okay.
With, say, local recovery plans, okay. Like what are used for individual populations,
sure.
Within Australia. There's no doubt that we need more detailed ecological studies on individual species so that we can understand their requirements better. We need to also have resources for long-term monitoring of populations, which we haven't had a really good history of doing that very well with any organisms in Australia. But it's essential for us to keep track of what's going on. So we need mainly money to do that. Long-term monitoring. Then for, again, individual populations, fire management might be an issue. Controlling weeds, controlling grazing around the edges of areas where frogs are breeding, recreational access to froggy areas. Again, a lot of damage can be done to habitat, particularly to vulnerable frogs like, say, the Baba frog in the Alps, which is in sphagnum bogs. People visit those bogs and they get damaged very easily. Then we've got reintroduction programs, relocation programs, where we have been able to restore habitat. And, of course, involving the community is very important as well. I mentioned the volunteers in the Melbourne area that collect data on their local frog populations. So on a small scale, those are the sorts of things we can be doing. Chytrid fungus is an issue that people are sort of wringing their hands with globally. It's very difficult to control in a similar way that we were going through Phytophthora control in this country decades ago,
right.
Trying to control the spread of that fungus. So there's no clear solution to that yet. Habitat loss, the answer to that is obvious.
Stop clearing.
Stop clearing, basically,
yep.
And start restoring habitat.
Which is the same for most of our wild species anyway. Most of our wild animals, that is the solution, isn't it?
Yeah, but, I mean, often, you see, but for any particular population of frogs, it's going to be a combination probably of several factors, and they're going to vary between populations. What for one particular population, it might be atmospheric population, pollution that's the main issue, or it might be water pollution. It might be agricultural runoff, chemicals that are causing the issues. So, again, we have to control those on an individual basis for particular populations of frogs or for particular species with very limited distributions. And, I mean, we have made attempts to do that. UV radiation was a very big concern decades ago. It seems to be less a concern now, but the ozone hole is still there. We managed to control most of the CFCs that were causing the main problem with ozone depletion. But, I mean, just recently it's come out that there's a lot of Chinese factories that are behaving illegally.
Yeah.
And putting out new types of CFCs that are, again, affecting ozone. So we have to be vigilant about controlling that. They got rid of DDT for the most part in the U.S. in agricultural systems, but there's still a heck of a lot of it in Mexico just across the border. And DDT had massive influences on frog populations.
Right. Mm. You're talking about wholesale change to the whole system
that
needs to be done for frogs. And like we say, I mean, it's pretty much these changes are needed for all our wild animal species.
Well, we have to keep in mind that Australia is the driest continent after Antarctica. And our freshwater resources in this country are severely limited. Mm. And look what we've done to the darling. With all of those fish kills in the past few months that have been in the news, there simply isn't enough water flowing in that major river system to support the wildlife that should be there.
Indeed, it's devastating. And as everybody no doubt knows, is that there's this sixth mass extinction that's going on right now. And as we've talked about, the global biodiversity crisis is caused by habitat destruction and by pollution and by agricultural practices and by fragmentation of forests and by climate change, which means in a nutshell it's caused by humans, right?
Yes.
So how can we prevent these extinctions when these causes seem to be so central to how our civilization has developed to this point in time? It seems that human civilization is pretty much incompatible with healthy ecosystems. And it suggests to me at least that humans have to virtually cease to exist or at least have to have some degree of economic collapse in order to give wild animals a chance.
Well, some really interesting facts came out of that recent UN report earlier this month. I haven't been able to see the full report, but I've looked at the summary. And it's been estimated that we are producing enough food around the world to feed every human being adequately. It's the food distribution that's the problem. But consumption levels of humans are also enormously high. since 1980, there's been an enormous, almost doubling of consumption. That's gone beyond what the human population has increased, you know. So we're using lots and lots more in terms of resources, not just producing more people. There's no doubt that the number of people on the planet are massively impacting other species, our fellow travelers, if you like.
Yeah.
But, I mean, as an individual, and especially in a wealthy country, we should be well aware of our consumption levels and the impact that they're having on other species. Now, I heard one of the shock jocks on the news the other night saying, forget about the UN report, it's nonsense, climate change, nonsense. Why should we destroy our economy when Australia's contribution to the total CO2 emissions is minuscule? So with that sort of attitude, no compromise whatsoever, we're in dire straits.
Indeed.
And unfortunately, the rest of the planet is as well.
Yeah, I don't know even how to respond to those kind of statements from people. Like, you know, where do you go from there? If they've completely shut out the facts and the science about where we're headed. And those shock jocks have enormous reach, enormous influence, and it's frightening what's going to happen next. But I think you're right. I think consumption seems to be at the root of all the things that are going wrong. I think it's a world gone mad.
Well, as the lucky country, so to speak, even though Australia's population is tiny compared to lots of other places, I think we should be setting an example.
Indeed.
We can afford to do it if we put our minds to it.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, I just got one last question before we go. I just want to know, what is the correct way to touch and handle a frog? Like, when you found a frog and you want to relocate it to somewhere safe, you found it, you know, under the cupboard or whatever it is, and you need to go and take it outside and put it in a nice little wet, moist area under a leaf, what's the best way to move it without impacting its health?
Yes, I recently gave a talk to the New Melbourne Frog Group, and I was embarrassed because a lot of my photos, early photos, showed me handling frogs, bare-skinned, basically, which is a big no-no now. And so I had to apologize for those early Kodak moments. But yes, for all sorts of reasons, not just the health of the individual frog, but the spread of diseases like this chytrid fungus.
Right.
And you almost exclusively handle frogs with disposable plastic gloves now.
You mean like those latex surgical gloves?
Well, it doesn't have to be that heavy. It can just be a light plastic glove. There's any sort of barrier like that that prevents you from contacting the skin of the frog.
Okay.
And if you're out in the bush and you need to move a frog, you have to find a plastic bag and do it.
Okay. So you can just use any old plastic bag and use that as a glove to move him.
Preferably a clean one. Yeah.
So it's really good just not to have skin-to-skin contact with a frog.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So that's the 101.
Yep.
Cool. I can take that on board. Now, thank you very much, Dennis. It's been great talking to you. That's all we have time for today. We've got our contact details here, info@freedomofspecies.org. And you can follow Freedom of Species on Facebook and on Twitter. And up next, there's In Psychedelia at 2 o'clock. So I'm just going to leave you with another song, Gotcha, and it's called Eyes Wide Open. And then I'm going to have another song after that, and it's Colin Hay. You might remember Colin Hay from Men at Work, and he's going to be playing Overkill. So stay tuned for In Psychedelia, and we'll see you next week.
Surprise, In 2019, 3CR has the power. Add your support during the annual Radiothon to Power Radical Radio. Radiothon starts 3rd of June. To donate, call 03 9419 8377 or donate online at 3cr.org.au. 3CR Radiothon 2019. Power Radical Radio.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.